don't you worry about me, for crying out loud. That's the last thing. I'll tell you, I come from a hard school, son. I remember one time I'm driving along in the darkness there, and not many people write about driving in the darkness, boring your way through the night with a pair of headlights, reaching out into that gloom, just reaching forward. This is an American night. This is American thing, driving in the darkness. I'm driving in the darkness one night, and it's way out in the deep bowl of the Midwest out there, see. As I say, I come from a hard school, son, and I've seen them happen, and I've seen them come, and I've seen them go, and it's up to my blooming knickers. And I'm out there on U.S. 41, which slashes across Indiana like the ribbon across an ambassador's chest. Slashes it diagonally from left to right, right down, then hangs in there like a great big fat old steel girder. Well, U.S. 41 is one of the more desolate stretches of American highwayage. Dark, nothing but flatness on all sides, and you can see even in the darkness, you can see that there is nothing. There's nothing flatter than Indiana at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, you see. It's not like, believe me, driving at night in the Midwest, in certain areas of the Midwest, is nothing like driving through Jersey. Nothing. Any part of Jersey. It is black. Black. And once in a while, you can see way up, millions of miles ahead, you see a tiny, tiny light, and you know that you're coming to another crummy little town with a biblical name, like New Jerusalem, or Old Babylon, or Upper Sodom. Hey, oh, yes, you can just see it hanging down there, and you can see it coming up, and then whew, you go through, and there's been this one little light hanging over U.S. 41, and you can see the Esso station, and you see the hardware store in the gloom, and, whew, and you're through. New Jerusalem is receding again into the darkness, and you're out there on that old highway just a setting down there and a drilling. Well, one night, I'm going along, it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm heading south, right down through Indiana. And I'm hanging over there in the outer lane. I always play it cool. I'm hanging in the outer lane there, and it's a four-lane highway, and I see these lights coming up from behind me. Past he goes. An insane fool in a 1949 Ford, flat out. You see those two lights, and he's gone. And maybe 20, 30 minutes later, I'm still born through the darkness. I see those lights. I see a pair of lights off to the right on the side of the road. And he's pulled off, you know, on the shoulder. And I can see his lights are there, and they're sort of laying out across a cornfield. And I'm watching. He's off there to my left. He's cut across the other lanes, and he's on the other side of the road, see? And I figure, is the guy in trouble or what? And I sort of slow up, and I see in the light of this guy's headlights, I see this guy, a tall, thin, obviously a 49 Ford flat-out driver, a tall, thin guy wearing a blue shirt, and he's got a pair of suspenders, and he is painting on a great big rock. He's got a white bucket of paint, and he's painted on this great big rock. Where did you get that? He's painting it on a great big rock there. See, she got the wrong one. You weren't listening, neither one of you. Now, put that one aside and throw it out. I don't know where you got that. That's something that's left over from Studio X. Has nothing to do. We'll put it away then. Put it away then. So, nevertheless, he's painting it on the side of this thing, and it's the first time in my life and the only time I've ever seen it actually being painted. He was slopping it on a great big rock, Jesus Saves, at 3 o'clock in the morning. Why he was driven to drive at 95 miles an hour south on U.S. 41 at 3 o'clock in the morning to arrive at a rendezvous with a rock with a great big can of white paint wearing a blue denim shirt, I will never know. Like I will say, it is not like driving through Jersey. At 3 o'clock in the morning. So I have slowed up, you see. I'm going to help the guy. So then I see what he's doing. He's painting it on there. And I realize now what he's doing, you know. So I say, okay, and away I go. Well, I'm maybe 20 minutes along in the darkness there, and I'm boring away, and you sort of get into this, you know, and my radio's, I'm searching all over the dial for something to keep me awake, and WHAS is coming in Louisville, and I listen to that for a while, and I shift on down, and I pick up WSM in Nashville. I pick that up for a while, and it's going along. And I see these twin lights coming from behind me, and There goes God's envoy. 104 miles an hour in his 49 Ford. Now it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's heading south towards Richmond, Indiana. Shoom! And sure enough, 20 minutes later, there I see him pulled off, this time off to the right. And there's that gaunt figure wearing that blue denim shirt, those great big cross white suspenders, with that great big white can of paint. This time he's working on the side of a barn. And you can see, faded into that red barn, you can see that gigantic bull. That great big old bull that's been painted onto that side maybe 50 years before, and it's faded off, and all you can see is just kind of glowing through the darkness the letters, Her Hero. And over that, he's painting in great big white letters his message. Shoom! I go past. I don't slow up this time. That guy raced me all the way to the Ohio border. All the way! At 105 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour in his 49 Ford. The hounds of hell nipping at his hocks all the way. A night rider, a solitary carrier of his own message, letting it ring out. Shoom! It would go. And as far as I know, he went right on through that southern tip of Ohio and cut into Kentucky. Shoom! Right through Lexington at 6 o'clock in the morning. He holed up in some haystack during the daylight hours, and then as soon as night struck, shoom! Down towards Memphis. Out of Memphis at 3 o'clock in the morning, shoom! Heading for Alabama. Through Huntsville, shoom! Through Mobile, shoom! Through Montgomery, shoom! And finally all the way down into the pecan groves. Banging it out, screaming it out, bellowing it out with his white paint. Yeah. Yeah, been there in a tough school. It reminds me of this. Did you read this this piece? A piece came in from the AP. And messages are pretty hard to deal with. And in fact, I've often felt that that a man with a burning truth is a dangerous man. It's not the truth that's dangerous, it's this man. We often confuse the two. In fact, that's one of the things that has made, in a way, the dialectic communists a dangerous crew. Have you ever dealt with a communist? Oh, boy. A communist, I've known them, and believe me, I am not a chauvinist, but there's a magnificent article of this current month in Atlanta. No, Atlas, rather. Atlas, which is a compendium of World Press, about the communist purges and the communist killings, the mass killings in communist Russia through the 30s. They estimate that something like 10 million people died. More people died there because of the regime that died under Hitler in Hitler's Germany. It was fantastic. Well, it's this wild thing, you see, this wild thing. And there was a piece came through on the AP the other day. It comes from Mount Clemens, Michigan. You know anything about Mount Clemens, Michigan? Michigan, rather. Mount Clemens, Michigan. Try to say that together. Interesting phrase. Do you know anything about Mount Clemens, though? It's a pottery center. Mount Clemens is a place where they make... You know this terrible pottery you see that is sold... These awful things that are sold in roadside stands all over the country? The pottery queen? No. Not yard decor. Pottery. This is pottery. Well, that's pottery too, but this is pottery. They sell stuff that they call it California type dinnerware and that sort of thing. It's very artistic type pottery, and they sell pigs in the form of banks and banks in the form of pigs and all that jazz. Well, Mount Clemens, Michigan, is a town that is based on the Pottery Foundation, and it's a funny little town. I've been through Mount Clemens. There are several little towns out in the Midwest that do nothing but make pots. Well, that produces a strange kind of man, apparently. It's a very basic endeavor, you know, making a pot. And it has a lot of connotations. And Mount Clemens, Michigan, is a pottery town. And it's laying out there in southern Michigan all by itself. Well, being by yourself is enough to make you go a little loco. My mother used to have a phrase, logos on the bogos. Did you ever hear that phrase? Yeah, he's Logos and the Bogos, yes, sir. You never heard that? Well, I'm sorry. You people, apparently there's a very rich language that most of you are missing by not being Americans, but by being Easterners. You have a very... Logos and the Bogos is a typical Midwestern phrase. Now watch, it's going to start sweeping New York here. That's a great phrase, Logos on the Bogos. Well, anyway, there's something about... What does it mean? It means that you flipped your lid. Simple as that. It doesn't quite mean that. It means a guy who's... everything's a little out of focus. It doesn't mean a flipper. It doesn't mean a guy who's flipped. It means a guy that just, you know, like there's something loose up there. One of the bolts has become unscrewed. In fact, that's what they used to call it. That's another phrase. He's got a screw loose. Did you ever hear that one? Meaning that the machinery's not working so good. You know, there's something wrong there. Well, anyway, these little towns do it. Well, listen to this one. This is from the Associated Press. Jacob Rubrick, 39, crashed his speeding car into a suburban trailer park, at 8 a.m. Sunday morning, shaking up the occupants of four trailers parked in the trailer park. The deputy sheriffs quoted him as saying, "God told me to go down there to wake those people up and get them to church. God told me to go down there, wake those people up and get them to church." Macon County Sheriff Lester Olmsted said the eight occupants of the trailer escaped serious injury. Dorothy Newport suffered a back injury when she was thrown out of bed. The other occupants, including an infant and a small girl, were badly shaken up and bruised. Rubrick, who suffered a bump on the head, was jailed without questioning. He later was transferred to a hospital. He said he attacked on the way three deputies who were guarding him. He says, "I'm carrying God's message to those people living in that trailer camp. God was telling me when I was driving my car, wake those people up, them sinners. Get them off the church. Get them off the church." Boom! Olmsted estimated the sheriff was traveling between 80 and 90 miles an hour when he plowed his car right through the trailer court. All the trailers in the court were torn loose from their foundations when his 1947 Mercury struck. Boom! Boy, speaking of the manic, this is WORAM and FM New York. And we have here the Paper Book Gallery. Speaking of manic. And they're at 399 6th Avenue, which is just off of 8th Street in the heart of the village. And it is generally considered among the paper book industry as being the originator of the entire idea of a store devoted completely and exclusively to quality paperbacks. But that's not the message tonight. They've been involved with the show now for, I don't know how many years. It's been four or five, hasn't it? Ever since they started. But they have a gigantic... it goes without saying they got a great collection of paperbacks down there. But they also have all the back copies of The Realist. They're the only ones who do. They have an exclusive with Krasner on that. They have a tremendous collection of completely insane records. I must say this. And anyone who's been down there... I got an angry letter from a guy who said he looked at those... He spent over 2 days looking at those records, and he couldn't even find a label he could read, much less understand or ever heard of. These are records like you couldn't possibly conceive of. And if you buy one, they will throw in another one free. And they only cost 97 cents to begin with. But this is only if you're a listener, as Marty would put it. That's the Paper Book Gallery, 399 6. Okay? Now, I don't know how many of you have ever had the chance to become involved with the true fanatic. Now, we've given you two stories of true fanaticism at work. There's something connected with speed. I've noticed that speed has something to do with fanatics. You notice in both cases they were traveling at 90 to 100 miles an hour? Something to do with speed, and I can't explain it without going for 4.5 hours here, but I'll never forget, speaking of fanaticism, it takes many forms. Have any of you ever had an occasion to be in the Kentucky Hills? There are several very fanatical religious groups that are in the Kentucky and, in fact, some of the Tennessee areas. And I remember one time, I in connection with a story I was doing, I was working with another guy on a documentary that we were doing. It was a documentary that was done on both television and radio that had to do with the... It was a study of fanaticism, but not religious fanaticism per se. Fanaticism as a phenomenon. It's a very interesting phenomenon. You will find that zealots, whether it's a religious zealot, whether it's a sexual zealot, whether it's a freedom zealot, and whatever the zealot is, there is a connecting link that runs, and they will all recognize one another. Regardless of the message they carry, it is an unwritten kind of fraternity. They recognize one another. I'm doing a television show in another city, and for those of you who view it, it's in Philadelphia, as a matter of fact. And for those of you who view it, I've been getting all kinds of letters asking why I haven't been on it. Well, it's because I've been in rehearsal for a play. But I have had the occasion to be in conversation with zealots of one kind or another, fanatics of one kind or another. And I use the word fanatic not in a derogatory sense, but in a descriptive sense. A man who is single-mindedly devoted to a cause to the complete exclusion of all other considerations, above and beyond the normal wider perspective or scope that other people would have. A man who will brook no interference with his ideas, nor also will he brook any argument with his ideas. An interesting kind of person. And most people have only read about them, have not really had a chance to deal with a true high-level fanatic. Say, for example, George Lincoln Rockwell. Interesting fanatic. And by the way, I use the word interesting not in a sense of approving of Mr. Rockwell. Somebody's going to call up and say, all right, wait, somebody that's right. No, I'm talking about interesting from a scientific and sociological sense. Malcolm X, dozens of others. But they're a fascinating crew. And yet, I found one thing very interesting about them, is that they all have high regard for other fanatics, even if the fanatics that they are talking about are diametrically opposed to them. It's a fascinating thing. For example, I'm sure that in spite of the fact that Hitler and Stalin were diametrically opposed by political belief, at least that's what the definition of communism and fascism is, were somehow drawn to one another by the fact that they were brother fanatics. They were brother brand burners. And what they burnt brands for and what they wrote on walls for meant nothing to them. It wasn't even important. It was that they were drawn together. It's as though a man who is a top-flight, big, tough, tycoon, a real rugged businessman will often be drawn to Khrushchev because they recognize something in each other. They're fanatics. The medium that they work in is unimportant. Understand what I'm saying here? And I found this out by dealing with many fanatics, and you will find it just absolutely throws you to find that one fanatic who you will think, you see, really believes in what he believes in. You know, he really talks about this. You would assume then he would have a deadly hate for another fanatic who believes in the opposite creed. But I have never found it to work that way, interestingly enough. As a matter of fact, I heard, and this, of course, I don't want to go into names here. I don't want to go into actual, because the minute you start dealing with actual creeds and actual fanatics, then it clouds the issue. But I tell you this, that I've heard four nationally known leaders of various kinds of very militant minority group thinking who are apparently opposed to one another if you look at their beliefs. I have heard all four of them say great things about one another. Fascinating. So I've come to the conclusion that fanaticism has nothing whatsoever to do with what a man is fanatical about. And I've seen this in action many times. So if a man is fanatical about love, he would not hesitate to kill in favor of love. So a man who is fanatical about peace will kill in the cause of peace, thereby completely destroying his, apparently, his premise. But you have to understand the quality of fanaticism to understand why he would do it. And so I remember in the Kentucky Hills, a funny thing, I spent a Sunday with a group who had assembled. You've heard of the snake worshippers? Well, these are people who demonstrate their religious beliefs by fondling poisonous snakes. Now, it's much more complicated than that. This is an oversimplification of it. But the thing that went on that I found very interesting was that there was a certain quality around the whole meeting of a strange sort of, even though there were great signs to the effect about love, and Christian brotherhood and love and so on all around, as far as you could see, these big signs were in the woods there. And yet, there was a fantastic amount of almost mordant hate for the outside world, for those who did not adhere to this kind of thing, that those who did not believe. And there was, I tell you, brethren, sister, I tell you that all the infidels and all the heathens surrounding us in this parallel, sin-benighted world are all heading straight to hell. And and there was a big sign over him that said love. And with that, he reaches down in this great big basket and takes out a 4.5-foot diamondback. And it's reaching out and lashing around, and bang, it smacks him right in the wrist. And I tell you, at 20 minutes later, he's out back of the trailer, and he's out colder than a cucumber. And the service goes on. Well, most of this stuff, I'm sure, to most of you, is theoretical. You don't know about fanaticism, because fanaticism doesn't play much in the life of the average man, because the average man is not hung up, really, to that extent. A true fanatic is a man who is just supremely hung up. That is not to say that the average man does not hold beliefs, or I don't want to use the phrase average man, I'm sorry, but that is not to say that less fanatical people do not hold strong beliefs. They do. But that's not quite the same as being hung up. That's a little different through the exclusion of everything. But I remember another, speaking of seeing the hang-ups of the true fanatic at work, I remember, of course the problem with a fanatic is that a fanatic, due to the fact that he has at least 9,000% more passion about his hang-up than anybody around him, his passion seems then to have conviction. And because it has conviction, it seems to those less passionate to be true. Passion is often confused for truth. Very often. It's easy to sway people. And for this reason, many of the almost every dictator, without exception, has been a fanatic. Because it takes maniacal devotion to yourself and your cause to finally get to the top and be able to sway and control and move and make like 100 million people march. This takes a maniacal devotion. Now, this maniacal devotion to this, whatever this fanaticism happens to be, is often mistaken by those around this man as proof of the truth, that anyone who is this maniacally devoted to this must have truth on his side. Must have, because after all, you know, you see a lot of it in the work. Have you ever seen Castro work? Castro is another example of the true zealot. And for that reason, he can sway a lot of people. Now, I'm not arguing about his beliefs here at all. Again, remember, I'm not discussing any of the political beliefs of any of the various zealots or any of the various fanatics. I am not discussing that. I am discussing the quality of fanaticism itself. So a real fanatic will often recognize, the only kind of people that he will recognize is a fellow fanatic. It is as though there is a light in the eye of one fanatic that ignites the light in the eye of his fellow fanatic. And for this reason, you'll find very strange bedfellows often in the world of the fanatic. For example, it's intriguing to note that many a man who is fanatically devoted to the cause of racial equality will also have a strange, almost what seems to be a completely diametrically opposed or a diametrically self-canceling respect for a man who preaches exactly the opposite. Now, you would say, well, now, how could this be? Oh, what do you mean how it could be? Because the quality of fanaticism knows no belief. Fanaticism does not operate with a belief at all. Intriguing thing. I don't know how I got on this tonight, but I haven't run across this piece about this guy running through the trailer camp, and I was reminded of a lot of things that had to do with fanaticism. Now often people will consider a fanatic insane. He will be called insane if the thing that he's fanatical about is not socially approved as a good cause. Now, do you follow that? Now, if a man happens to be a fanatic, we'll say, on racial problems, he is quite often hailed as a good man, in spite of the fact that he could also be a highly dangerous man, just as this man here, who was obviously hung up on religious causes. At the same time, he practically killed 9 people with his mercury. And so many people will applaud him merely because he is hung up on something that they themselves believe in. And the mere fact that he ran over 9 people and knocked over 7 trailers is only incidental to his great belief, or is an unfortunate situation. They will kind of pass it off that way. I've seen that happen. I'll never forget, again, speaking of the fanatics, a very strange little thing. It's not necessarily fanatics, but it's a kind of a tie-in with it. That quite often you will find men who are religious zealots will often have a peculiar grudging respect for underworld figures. Oh, don't say no kidding. It's true. They will, in a strange way. That there was a situation, for example, in Chicago at one point, where a famous gangster was the closest intimate to a famous church leader in Chicago. It's the famous story. Now, they were both single-mindedly dedicated to a cause, but they recognized in their almost fanatical dedication to their cause a brethren thing. They were brothers. They were brother fanatics, really, is what it is. They were brothers under the skin. Well, of course, I don't believe in what you believe in, Charlie, but, you know, it's a funny thing. I respect the fact that you really believe in it, you know. And the next thing you know, they're down there getting a drink together. Well, this was a famous story. Nobody could seem to understand it. Well, you can't understand it when you realize that fanaticism has very little to do with what you believe in. Have you ever yourself, for example, gotten impassioned in an argument? You're standing in the middle of a living room, you see, and the next thing you know, you're yelling and screaming at about three or four guys, and you're absolutely idiotically wrong. You know you're wrong now. All of a sudden, it occurs to you you're wrong, but you continue to yell at them. Ah, source your own man. What do you mean, for crying out loud? You don't know what the devil you're talking about. Yeah, a nut like you. What are you talking about? Oh, you're Madison Avenue, man. You're a rotten mad man. You sold out. What you're doing there is you're demonstrating fanaticism, you see, only on a very small scale. That you are screaming and yelling about a cause, even though you know that you're wrong now about the cause, but what are you really doing? You're attacking these people. You're not at all trying to convince them of your cause any longer. Yeah, you're rotten. Well, now that's what a true fanatic will often do. People wondered, you see, why, for example, a guy like Hitler and Stalin could get together and make a pact, even though they were sworn enemies. Oh, no. Not really, you see. Not really. This is, in a sense, an essay on the nature of tyranny, that many people are prone to listen to a genuine fanatic and listen only to the thing he's fanatical about, and believe in the cause that he is fanatical about, little realizing that they are putting in charge of their cause a fanatic who is blood kin to a genuine diamondback. But it seems to be right, you see, because what he's for is a good thing. People are continually confused, for example, after Castro got in. They couldn't understand why 5 minutes after Castro got in. By the way, a true fanatic cannot exist under any other circumstances than absolute embattlement. A fanatic is no good unless he's fighting against outside forces, external forces. I'm sure that many a wild peace fanatic, for example, was quietly disappointed when, after the blockade of Cuba, a rain of atom bombs did not descend on New York. Because, you would think they would be fought. No. The embattlement is much more important than what you're battling for, to a true fanatic. So many people cannot understand why, after Castro got in, and he was literally hailed, he was given the American equivalent of knighthood, if you recall. He was on the Jack Parr show. He was on the Ed Sullivan show. That's as high as you can get, you know. That's why it took Nixon 8 years as vice president to make the Parr show. It really did. So 5 minutes after he got in, he probably went back to the palace in Havana, and it was dull. He's walking around, and the fight's over, you know. And so the next thing, señores and señoritas, I got to get the fight going again. So there will always be a fight where there's a fanatic. The fight is never over. Never, ever, ever over. Can't possibly be. Because the minute the fight is over, then who wants to, where do you go from here? What fun is this? it's really a strange thing to see. This is called the true revolutionist. He's not interested in the cause for which he is revolting. He is interested in a revolution. Revolutions are fun, you know, if you're the leader. There is hardly a feeling that is more... let's say, subtly enjoyable than the feeling of being right surrounded by wrong. That's a great feeling. Oh, yes. You know yourself that it's a great feeling to know that you didn't commit the axe murder when you pick up the Post and there it is on page 3. It really is. It's a great feeling to be right. Now, you can only be right if there is wrong. Just like white only exists if there's other colors. Just like darkness only exists if there is light. And so, if you are right, you have to insist on a wrong being around. So, if a man is a true revolutionist, you see, he is much more interested in that feeling than he is in the cause he espouses. In short, let's take a mythical country, and let's say there is a tyrant. Well, you are a true revolutionist. You want to get rid of the tyrant, and you are for good things. You are for everybody being happy and everybody loving everybody. You are for free subway tokens and all this. You're for everything. And here's this rotten, you know what? And he's up there, and he's got his paid hirelings and thugs. Well, all right, so you go up in the hills, wherever it is, this is your and you get other guys around you until finally you go in and you blow them up. And then one day you are carried through the streets and you have gotten rid of the tyrant. Well, all right, then what? Well, then after that you start handing out free subway tokens. Well, you know, that's kind of dull after a while. You give out the subway token, everybody's riding the subway now. So you're sitting there, and the next thing that occurs to you is, oh, I know what now. I found it. I know where the rotten ones are now. The rotten ones are all the ones who are pretending to be for us. And actually, they're pretending because what they're going to do is come in and they're going to take away, they're going to charge 4 cents for the subway tokens again. They're going to do the whole thing all over again. So let's go out and get them. And then there's all that wonderful excitement again. And once again, you're in that beautiful position, that wonderful human, lovely, lovely position of being right surrounded by wrong. You have to create wrong. And so after you see this operating, it explains a great deal. It really does. It explains, for example, the feeling that is a wonderful warm feeling of sitting in a nightclub where the hip comic is putting down all the world except the hip nightclub. He doesn't put that down, and he doesn't put down the guys who are sitting in the hip nightclub, the paid customers. And everyone feels that he is together with the right people. We have the right here, and out there is the wrong. This is one of the reasons why people will drop a hip comic the minute he becomes part of the great world out there. Because then there's no longer a feeling of right and wrong. All of a sudden, all the wrong people are cheering him. And so then you have to find another one, and another one, and another one, and another one. So the point is, in the end, you've got to realize that they're not really for what the guy's saying. They're for the fact that they're the only ones who are understanding what he's saying. Very difficult condition here. And the embattled is always a very important thing. You see a lot of Middle Eastern people, for example, for centuries, for generations, generation on generation on generation, the whole country is built on a feeling of wrong. That we are wrong. We are wronged people. That other country is getting after us now. And even if the other country is pure desert, they will say that the cactuses are getting ready to come after us. These are the cacti. And there is a there's a funny thing. I suppose in the end you have to say there is no end to it. It will always be this way. There will always be tyrants. Never will we arrive at a day when there won't be. Because being a tyrant is a very basic drive, desire, a very basic thing. A tyrant really is the lead fanatic of any particular cause. And there will always be the feeling. We want, and the more our world becomes automated, in short, the more we are detached from the mere scut problems of earning a living and making shoes and stuff, the more we will develop these things. I will say, like Pandora, we've opened a fantastic box with the first transistor. Really. And it ain't going to see any end. I'll never forget that 49 Ford. Shoo! And that white paint gleaming in there and those yellow headlights. 95 miles an hour, 105, 110. Woo! Jesus.